I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Look around you. Whether you've been paying attention or not, chances are you've been doing your part to build the new Chinese economic empire. Chances are that over the last 10 years, the shoes that you buy have all started to come from China, same with your kids' toys. Other things like football helmets and baseball gloves. In the last year alone, China surpassed all other countries as the top exporter to the United States of televisions and computers and DVD players. This weekend, the premier of China, Wen Jiabao, comes to Washington, and it won't be Taiwan or Tibet or human rights at the very top of the agenda. It'll be money. China has become so economically powerful that U.S. administrations no longer wag their fingers in disapproval at their Beijing counterparts. So, just how powerful is this new Eastern Empire? And as the U.S. focuses on Iraq and its war on terror, does America also run the risk of being blindsided by China's rise to economic and military power? Can you imagine a day when China competes with the U.S. for global superpower status? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined on the line from Beijing by Time Magazine's bureau chief there, Matthew Forney. Matthew, nice to have you on the program.
Good morning.
You spend a lot of time on the road there. Tell us what you see as hard evidence of this economic boom in China. Give us an example.
Okay. My most recent trip came after the U.S. imposed textile quotas on China, Chinese bras, bathrobes, and knitwear. So I'd never been to a bra factory and don't know that much about bras, so I thought I'd look into it. And I went to a factory in Zhejiang province, which is about 300 miles from Shanghai. It's kind of one of the boomiest parts of booming China. I went unannounced to a factory that produces all for export, mostly very pretty lace brassieres, not really knowing what to expect. But the manager let me in. And the accusations against China were not so much illicit trading practices, but it was the U.S. imposed these quotas because of surging Chinese exports. But U.S. Textile manufacturers often accuse China of labor abuses in textile factories and say that they're state-run enterprises which enjoy subsidies from the government and some unfair trading advantages. What I found was that it was a privately run firm with about 400 employees, which I'm told is fairly typical. No government subsidies, bank loans available. When I went in, the manager was taking me through, and the first thing he pointed out to me was a sign on the wall, laminated, which had been given to them by Disney, because at some point they were producing bras with Disney characters on them, and Disney must distribute these to anybody who makes Disney products. And it had been translated into Chinese, and it was their labor practices, and he made a point of showing me the line that said they're not allowed to use forced labor, indentured servitude, or slavery. And he thought that was pretty funny. As we were walking through the factory, it was 400 women, mostly in their 20s, with blue kerchiefs on their head and hunched over sewing machines, sewing C cups together. In a well-lit factory, they work 8-hour shifts. They live 4 to a dormitory room when their shifts are over. They make about $100 a day, and they really couldn't be happier about it. I talked to one woman who had come from another province. Many of them were from other provinces.
Quick check, Matt. You said $100 a day. Is it $100 a day?
I'm sorry. Did I say that? About $100 a month.
Right. Okay.
Thanks. She had recently bought an electric moped and was very happy about that. Never thought she would buy one before. And so she had that and enough money to send home to her parents once a month, and she was very happy.
And the manager, does he have any trouble finding workers, any trouble finding people who want to buy the bras?
A little bit more now, because since the U.S. imposed its sanctions, he had been in negotiations with Sara Lee, which makes Victoria's Secret lingerie, and he was looking forward to starting to make lingerie for Victoria's Secret, but the negotiations broke off after the U.S. imposed its quotas. Wasn't going to break the factory, but it was an opportunity lost, and he had planned to expand his production line, and he couldn't do it. He wasn't going to lay off workers or anything, but
Is this the sort of manager, Matt, who hopes that the Chinese premier will be able to grab the attention of those in Washington and say, you know, we need to do more business. We need less of these tariffs and quotas. And I mean, does he have expectations that these things can be resolved?
I don't think he was thinking that politically, but he was aware enough to say, is this what the U.S. really wants to be competing with us, against us with? He said, why doesn't the U.S. stick to high-tech products? You make those well. When China gets ramped up to scale, nobody can compete with China on low-cost, labor-intensive products. And I think that's probably true.
Did you have an opportunity any time in the last few days just to talk with people in China about this visit, whether or not anybody knows it's taking place, whether or not it's on the radar there?
Yeah, Chinese are excited when any Chinese leader goes to the United States. It was an unusual occurrence for a very long time. Deng Xiaoping visited in the late 1970s, and then it wasn't until 1997 when former Chinese President Jiang Zemin visited the United States, and he was so pleased with it that he made a feature-length movie that showed in cinemas around China about his visit. Chinese are proud of their emergence as a world power, and there's no greater sign of that emergence than watching their leader stand shoulder to shoulder with the leader of the world's only remaining superpower. And Chinese are very interested in international affairs and their role in international affairs. They don't always, given the restrictions on Chinese media, they don't always get unvarnished information. But they do get a lot of information. One of the leading newspapers in China is called the Global Times, and it has nothing in it but international news. I'm not sure how long a newspaper like that would last in the United States, but in China it's one of the most read papers.
Matt, stay with us for a couple of minutes if you can. I'd like to bring my two other guests in for the program. Merle Goldman is here with me in our Boston studio. She's a China scholar at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard and professor emeritus of history at Boston University. Merle, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And you and Matt, I gather, were election monitors together at one point in China?
Right, a couple of years ago, Matt.
All right. That election didn't go well, as I remember.
Bonnie Glazer is also joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. She's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and independent consultant on Asian affairs to both the U.S. Departments of State and Defense. Bonnie, nice to have you with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And as, Bonnie, we listen to Matt's description of the way that Chinese people on the street are anticipating the visit, you must be struck by the way that those sorts of state visits attract attention in a place like China, but don't necessarily make the radar in a place like the United States.
Well, I think to some extent it's not surprising. Americans live in the country that is the superpower in the world. We tend to pay less attention sometimes to what is going on abroad. The Chinese are obsessed, I think, with the United States. They do pay a lot of attention to international affairs, as Matt said. And I think that that's for several reasons. They're lagging behind. They want to learn from the most advanced country. They want to become part of the international system. Secondly, I think that the Chinese really can't focus very much on domestic politics. To some extent, it's taboo. You can't get on the internet and criticize the leadership. And since those are forbidden areas of discussion, paying attention to international issues is a draw for Chinese. And so there are lots of movies that come from abroad that the Chinese like to see. They certainly frequent McDonald's. They watch TV shows from abroad, and they like to read news about the outside world, particularly about the United States. And I think they are very excited about this visit by their premier to the United States.
And I suppose, Merle, it's also a good opportunity to just measure the growth of that country as an empire now.
Right. It certainly is. If you look at China at the beginning of the 20th century, it was one of the poorest, the most isolated countries in the world. And at the end of the 20th century, it is one of the most dynamic countries of the world. And it's one of those mysteries how they were able to transform themselves in 100 years. It sounds like a long time, but in world history, it's not a long time. And I think part of it really has to do with their, in some ways, their traditional culture. The Confucianism, just to take that as an example, is a culture that emphasized education, hard work, determination. Those are the qualities you need today in the modern world. And I think, in part, that explains why China has moved so fast.
1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation this hour about the emerging empire. I mean, it's been emerging for a while, but we're taking note of it in part because of the state visit that's coming up this weekend. Let's take our first call from Hong Kong. Eric's joining us on the line. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out one of the big transformations that's taken place over the past, say, 6 to 8 months is the bureaucracy that's changed, and the bureaucrats are no longer the cadres of old communist era. These are very savvy, sophisticated people who graduated from Georgetown and Harvard and from Johns Hopkins are now back in China in the foreign ministry. They speak lots of languages, and as I've come in contact with quite a few of them, foreign ministry people over the past few months here, it's really remarkable to see how connected and how much better they understand the world than even some of our own diplomats do, and certainly than their predecessors did.
Matt Forney, do you see that in the way that China presents itself to the rest of the world, this new breed of diplomat?
Yeah, well, he spoke of the foreign ministry in particular, and the foreign ministry is interesting to me in part because it monitors journalists and is kind of our bureaucracy that we deal with the most. And you know, it used to be very hard for us to travel in China, hard for us to get information. The foreign ministry seems to recognize that more access is better, even if the news that comes out of China isn't news that the foreign ministry approves of, that it's better if they give us the access that we need. For instance, just a couple of months ago, the foreign ministry ran a group of journalists to Tibet, and those trips used to be very heavily monitored. Tibet is about the only place in China that I, as a journalist, still can't go to easily. I need permission to go there, and I need, I usually have a handler of some kind. But they ran a trip of us, they ran a group of us out there, about 30, from the major American media outfits. And we had a lot of time to ourselves. We weren't forced to use government translators. Those of us who could speak Chinese could sort of disappear for hours at a time and talk to whoever we wanted to very freely. It was a savvy move by the Chinese government to let us do that.
So what sort of headline do you think the Chinese are anticipating from this visit? I know already that they congratulated the United States for getting rid of the tariff on steel, but what kind of headline are you looking for from this particular visit then, Matt?
Well, given Chinese headline writers, it'll probably be something like, you know, China shows its power or something like that.
And I think what we'll do in the balance of this hour is talk about the way that the people see that and how that's changing the nature of the country itself, because you actually pick that up on the street as well, don't you, Matt? I mean, this sense.
Yeah,
that,
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I enjoy doing the most is going places, kind of migrant centers, places where Chinese are coming together from parts of China where they haven't been together before, Chinatowns within China. I was recently in Shenzhen, which was China's first special economic zone. It's where economic reforms began 20 years ago. It was a rice paddy at the time, and now it's about 5 million people. Most of them are in their 20s. Most of them are from all over China. Coming together away from home for the first time, away from their, you know, for most of them, they're the first ones in generations to leave their counties or their villages. Living together anonymously, nobody looking after them, young couples living together unmarried, going to discos with money in their pockets to spend.
Matt, I got to stop you there because we have to take a break. I want to thank you for being with us, and we will continue our conversation about China after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And as the Premier of China visits Washington this weekend, Wen Jiabao is here to talk about money and a chance, I think, probably for us to take a bit of a measure of just exactly what's happening in the changing relationship between China and the United States. With me on the program this hour, I have Bonnie Glaser. She's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Merle Goldman is a China scholar at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard. Merle, let me start with you. Would we say, Would we be proper to say now that China is already the next world empire, that it will be the next world empire, that it could be the next global empire?
I would say it could be. We've been talking about the dynamism of the Chinese economy, but they have many, many problems that people don't look at. Just take that example that Matt Forney talked about, all the immigrants coming in from the countryside mm-hmm. into the large cities. There are 200 million people leaving the farms, coming into the cities in search of jobs. They have to find jobs in the urban economy. And how the Chinese are going to be able to employ all those people, it's not clear. At the same time, they have 15 million people coming each year into the market, the labor market. And thirdly, they are privatizing their state industries, which means that the 120 million workers in state industries, at least half of those people, are going to lose their jobs. So literally, almost the population of the United States has to find new jobs in order to be employed. And that is a tremendous problem. So I see this as a dynamic economy, but one that has tremendous problems, even economic problems.
And Bonnie, when I was reading that story in this morning's paper about the phenomenal growth of Shanghai, 17 million people last year, 20 million this year, you get down into the later paragraphs, and it describes how Shanghai estimates that it created 400,000 jobs last year alone and lost 300,000 state jobs. So this kind of push and pull that Merle's talking about, does it stand to trip China up in its economic push forward?
Well, China could go many different directions, and one scenario is that it emerges as a very strong power. But there are many things that could trip China up in this path to its rise as a major power, and Merle has talked about some of them. There are other problems. There's problems with the Chinese environment. Pollution is terrible. The gap between the urban and the rural areas is growing tremendously. Medical care in the country, in many parts of the country, is very inadequate. There's a lot of criticism and pressure being put on the leadership from many different parts of the society. Younger people who want to have a university education, and there aren't enough colleges and universities in the country to provide that education. And so there are a lot of pushes and pulls on the society, and the Chinese leadership is trying to do its best to kind of keep the lid on and move the country very, very slowly forward.
Matt Forney, back in Beijing, do you see people protesting against this? Do you see, I mean, we hear stories of people, you know, angry with the government because they don't have health care and that sort of thing, but it's not the sort of thing that the administration there wants to see reported around the world. What do you see or hear about that?
You know, there's been something of a change in the kinds of protests we've been seeing recently in China. There are groups of people who would like to change the political system. There aren't that many. When you're in an economy that's growing this fast, most people tend to be satisfied. There's not a tradition of dissent in China. So there are a group of people who periodically, you know, form an organization or post something on the internet and are often arrested and sentenced to fairly lengthy prison terms. But that's not your typical protest here in China. Your typical protest until fairly recently was unemployed workers or retirees who weren't receiving their pensions. We're not seeing that so much anymore. Most of the demonstrations that we see now are people involved in housing disputes, and I think this reflects a lot of the changes in China. It's either people who have had their old homes torn down in favor of a new housing development, and they haven't been properly compensated for it, and accusations of corruption from the, you know, collusion between the local government and the construction companies, or else it's people who have bought property but don't feel they've, either because of land disputes, haven't been able to get the deeds granted to them, or feel somehow they've been ripped off by the developer and are organized and protesting. This latter group is especially interesting because it's usually middle-class people. And I find that interesting in a reflection of changing China, that probably the biggest cause of social unrest, or at least the kinds of, you know, 20, 30 people standing outside of City Hall or the local party headquarters, you know, with placards demanding to talk to somebody because they demand redress, it's usually people who are involved in housing disputes.
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation this hour about that emerging empire. Next to Beverly, Massachusetts. And Steve, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, one thing I often hear ignored is we've got this idea that America is the big superpower, but the reality is in our lifetimes, we're going to have to deal with we're number two. We're not going to be number one anymore. When the Chinese have, what, 20% of our per capita GNP, they're going to have a bigger economy than we do. We're already dealing with being fed economic data like this productivity figure that came out of the news this week, which is basically a made-up statistic to try and ignore what's really going on.
And, Bonnie, when we take the measure of empire, we have to look at military as well. There are stories of the Chinese purchasing lots of Russian equipment, fighter aircraft, bomber ships, submarines. Is that something that is a priority for the Chinese to build up not only the economic side of their strength but their military side?
It's certainly a priority for China to build a more professional military and to acquire advanced weapon systems. But we have to remember the Chinese are starting from a very, very low base. And the kind of equipment that they have procured so far from Russia and the kind of capabilities that they have may be threatening in the near term to their neighbors, and particularly toward Taiwan, which the Chinese regard as part of their country. But they lag very, very far behind the United States in areas of high technology and particularly military technology. I really can't foresee within the next half century the Chinese catching up. Remember, we will continue to move forward at the same time that they are developing military capabilities. It's also important to note that we and other countries have sanctions that continue to be in place that prohibit the sales of many kinds of military technology to China.
When you were saying, Bonnie, that it's not going to happen in the next half century, Merle, you were nodding your head. You agree with that?
I do agree with that. But I agree with that, perhaps for different reasons. Someone mentioned that they have a very well-trained bureaucracy. That's true. But they have a political system that is totally out of sync with the dynamic economy and the changing social structure. It is still the Marxist-Leninist party state. And it is a party state that has a few people at the very top. But this is a political structure that I think is going to have to change. And until that changes to one more appropriate to the changes going on the ground, I see this as a rather fragile system. So I don't see this as a dynamic superpower just pushing ahead.
But if that political system, though, is out of sync, as you describe it, there are also elements of that political system which contribute to the speed at which China marches ahead, because there is a government that is able to, and a people who understand that the government has the capability and the willingness to crack down when necessary. You've also got, as you mentioned earlier, all that's left over of communism, a sense of the importance of education, a high literacy rate. I mean, isn't there a bit of a balance there, Merle?
Oh, that's a good point. And you could also mention how they handled the Tsar's epidemic. Once they faced up to it, they handled it very effectively and very well. But that's the whole point. At first, they didn't face up to it. And so they have problems there that they're right. not facing up to because they don't want to bring these out into the open and deal with them.
Let me go back to Steve in Beverly here. I mean, Steve, what you're hearing from my guests here is this is leading you to believe that perhaps not in your or our lifetime will America become number two.
Well, it's certainly going to become number two economically. I mean, demographics is destiny. There's nothing we can do about it. There's more of them than there is of us. And even at 20-25% of the per capita GNP, they're going to have a bigger economy. Military power isn't everything unless we really want to be imperialists.
The point about the middle class fascinates me. And Matt Forney, I mean, I watched India about 10 years ago kind of struggling with its attempt to boom and grow. And at that point, I mean, it didn't really quite happen the way everybody thought it would. But everybody was watching the middle class. Will these people all start to buy their washers and dryer? Will the engine start from within? Do you see that in Beijing? Do you see it when you're traveling around the country?
When you're talking about purchasing power, the middle class, yes, I do. I mean, I've been in China for 10 years, and one of the most dramatic changes that I've seen is tourism. I mean, it used to be that if you were traveling to the most beautiful places in China as a foreigner, you had them to yourself. And it's not the case anymore. Chinese take holidays. They travel. They travel by car, and they didn't have cars before. Everybody. Most urban dwellers now have a refrigerator, probably a washing machine, a color television set, a DVD player on which they watch pirated DVDs. And this is mostly being driven by the middle class purchasing. Yeah, China's got a strong consumer movement now.
There was also all that news just a few weeks back about the Chinese putting their first man into space. Bonnie, was that an important expression of this new China in your view?
Oh, I think very much so. It's a signal to the Chinese people that they are emerging and to the rest of the world that they are a power that the world will have to contend with. But I don't think that necessarily indicates very much about where the technology is throughout the rest of the economy. And I think that aggregate measures of economic wealth can sometimes be misleading. And even if the Chinese in aggregate terms overtake the United States in GNP, what will their per capita income be? And what will their standard of living be? I think that figures today show that Chinese per capita income is about $1,000 US. They have a very long way to catch up with the United States and with other advanced industrialized countries.
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation this hour as we're talking about China and its emerging power in the East. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We'll take our next call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Donna's joining us. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I have an observation, I guess. I went to China in 1992 as an adoptive parent, and we returned last year just on a tour visit. And
where did you go in China, Donna?
I went to Changzhou, which is between Shanghai and Nanjing.
Mm-hmm.
The change that had occurred in that country in the space of 10 years was phenomenal. Just as a layperson, you know, not an economist.
What did you see? Give us a description.
My daughter's hometown, which is a large city by U.S. standards but not major by Chinese standards, we stayed in the same guest house that we had stayed in 10 years previously. 10 years ago, we would walk outside the gates, fairly narrow streets, little shop fronts. There was a street market a couple of blocks away where you could buy all kinds of things out on the street. When we went back, you walk outside the gates, and you look like you're in downtown Manhattan. Huge glass-fronted department stores that are so expensive, I'm intimidated going into them.
Did you see a change in the people, Donna?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's one thing to see the skyscrapers go up, but I'm trying to understand the psychology of the people that are there as well.
Well, we had a tour guide who was openly resentful of the wealth that some people have in China. And then there was an intern who joined us for a day, and all she talked about was getting a cell phone, and she was hoping that we were going to be able to get her some kind of connection to get wealthy. I mean, there was definitely excitement about the new wealth and a hope of getting in on it, as well as resentment that some people were getting in on it and some people weren't. People spoke also much more openly than they did previously in terms of politics. I came away feeling definitely like Americans don't really realize what tremendous economic potential there is in China and how hard that country is working to come up to and supersede the rest of the world.
Just quickly, one from you, Matt, on whether or not you hear and see this notion of the Chinese dream a la the American dream, that it's all about the pursuit of wealth, the way Donna's describing it.
You know, in a lot of ways, that's the plus and the minus to China. Because the Communist Party is still so firmly in control and controls so many aspects of society, It really does come down to money here in China a lot of the time. Religious expression is if not so much repressed as inhibited. There are people who have succeeded in society don't get to participate in society the same way they would in the United States. I mean, if you're in New York City and you're kind of a mover and a shaker, what do? You sit on the board of the ballet, you know, you participate in civic activities. And you really don't have that option in China because civil society is so under the control of the Communist Party. So what does that leave you with? It leaves you with money. If you make a lot of money in China, you can blow a lot of money. You build a big house, you buy a BMW, you know, you...
Something sort of empty about...
You're a guy, you have expensive women, you know, that's part of the culture of success here.
There's something kind of empty about that, Merle.
Well, there is, and consumerism is rampant. There's no question about that. But I like to just make a further point. It's true, when you go to the cities today, they are booming. But just go out a little way out from those cities, and you go into the countryside where the majority of the population lives, 700 million to 800 million people, and it is still very poor. It's changing. New roads are being built. Sewers are being built. But it is very poor. You go into a Chinese farmer's house, and they have wooden stools to sit on and maybe a board to sleep on. But this is not a society in which this wealth is spreading that quickly from the cities into the countryside. So you have the majority of the population still living, I believe, they're not below the poverty line, but they're certainly not very much above the poverty line. And that is a big problem I see for China.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation about how we measure the growth in China. I'll take this opportunity, Matt Forney, to thank you for being with us on the program. It's nice to have your insights.
That was my pleasure.
Matt Forney is Time Magazine's Beijing Bureau Chief, joining us on the line from that city. We have more questions, more callers, more things to talk about as we explore China after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. To The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK for you to join me and Bonnie Glazer, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Merle Goldman, China Scholar at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard. As we take a look at the changing relations between the United States and China and China's aspirations, hopes, and genuine efforts to become its own empire. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Quincy, Massachusetts. And Michael, you're up. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a quick question. Is I know that in the last 50 years, a large number of the Chinese population has been persecuted through various movements and, political means. And how has that affected the people of China at this point? Are they still being persecuted? I know, for example, that there's only, say there's about 300,000 internet police now that monitor the internet. And the latest movement has been the persecution of, say, a Falun Gong group. And how is that affecting the overall population in China?
Can we turn this, Michael, to what extent does it come up at weekend talks like this? I mean, we'll get to how it's being seen within the country in a minute, but maybe we can start there. Are you okay with that?
Sure.
Bonnie, these sorts of visits used to always be preceded by a lot of news reports and a lot of chatter about the human rights issues, and we're not hearing that in advance of this. Is that because of a change in the wind in Washington? How do you explain that?
Well, I think that human rights is still a very important part of the Bush administration's agenda with China. It isn't always on the front pages. But in President Bush's conversations with Chinese leaders, he usually does raise his concerns about the leadership's treatment of the people, the lack of religious freedom in the society. It is really usually quite prominent in his mind. That's what I have heard.
But it never comes with a club behind his back saying, if that doesn't change, then we're going to make these sorts of economic moves, does it?
No, I don't think that either country is looking to link one issue to another in the relationship. We certainly don't want to see China link our arms sales to Taiwan to its cooperation, for example, in eliminating nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. And so, no, we don't usually pursue that kind of linkage in our policy either. But we do, I think, very forcefully tell the Chinese what we hope them, what kind of progress we'd like to see in human rights, and we do press for the release of individual prisoners.
And Merle, back to the original part of Michael's question. What should we know, what should we be aware of in terms of the way that human rights are being regarded in China itself?
Good. It's a very good question. Certainly, during the Mao era, from 1949 to 1976, there millions of people were persecuted for their political, religious, even their economic beliefs. In the post-Mao era, that number has certainly diminished, and it's right now several hundred or you could say several thousands rather than millions. But nonetheless, people are still being persecuted if they organize in any way to try to set up, for example, a political party, another political party. Though anybody attempting to do that will be punished very, very harshly. So this is still a dictatorship of a small group of people, even though it certainly has lessened its controls over the population as a whole. This is no longer what we would call it's an authoritarian state, but it was what people would call a soft authoritarian state. Nonetheless, for example, the example about the what we call cyber dissidents. There are a group of people who use the internet to express their political views. The party has cracked down very harshly on them. They have released a few prisoners, but at the same time, they arrest some other prisoners who have used the internet to spread ideas, particularly about trying to bring about political reform in a democratic direction. That seems to be their major concern.
And when I reflect back on visits that have taken place in the past or encounters between American and Chinese politicians, am I wrong in thinking that when they went nose to nose, human rights were a higher priority in the past, that perhaps now, because of the economic power of China, it's harder for the Americans to wag a finger or wave a club?
I would say that the issue of human rights is lower down on the agenda. In other words, strategic issues, economic issues,
that's
Taiwan.
North Korea, the war on terror.
That's right. Yeah. War on terror, Taiwan, economic issues, certainly. They're really pressing issues immediately. And then they will finally get to the issue of human rights.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Nashville, Tennessee. Daisy, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm from Taiwan, and I think in many ways, I went to China to visit a couple times every year for work, and I found things very differently over there from Taiwan, but in a lot of ways, culturally, Taiwan is more Chinese than China, because China had this cultural revolution, and it really lost a lot of the cultural heritages, and even religiously, a lot of people were oppressed, especially the human rights thing with the Falun Gong group. Yeah, they were extremely oppressed, and the government's propaganda controlled the media so much that nobody knew the truth.
When was the last time, Daisy, that you were there in China?
In April.
And did you see at that time or get a sense at that time that despite the repression you're describing, that the country really is booming, that it is becoming an economic powerhouse that the rest of the world needs to take account of?
Of course, along the China coastal cities, extremely westernized, extremely modern, and it's very convenient. But when you go inland, like the lady just said, it's very poor. People there, they work all day for one renminbi, one Chinese dollar, not American dollar.
Right.
And they would do anything, clean the toilet, you know, mop the floor, everything.
So just this past week when the Taiwanese politician made a suggestion that there could be a referendum early in the new year, the Chinese said, and I think it was for the first time in a couple of years, they'd go to war against Taiwan rather than see that country move any further away from them. Is that an issue that still quite frightens people living in Taiwan?
You know, honestly, we're really used to it. I grew up, you know, practicing Chinese, coming to bomb us all the time. So we're really actually used to it. And China is, in a way, is a lot like North Korea now. They talk a lot, you know, for their face, but they don't really do as much. So we're not really worried. People are used to being frightened. So people just try to make it's economically that's really hurting us because the labor in China is so cheap, and all the Taiwanese company, all those high tech companies making chips and everything, they go and they invest in China and they're bringing all this money to China like every other foreign business. So it's really hurting Taiwan economically.
Daisy, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you,
Merle. When I'm listening to Daisy talk about the Taiwanese being hurt by China's economic strength, I'm thinking of also the South Koreans and the Malaysians and the Philippines, Indonesia, all those other once and current powerful economies in that part of the world. Is China drawing jobs away from them? Is China actually creating some animosity by exploiting its low currency and its cheap labor?
Oh, that's a very good question. In some ways it is, in some ways it's not. It's certainly true that they can underprice any of those countries in terms of their labor. But what you see in China today is that they're beginning to import from all these countries. So they also are a stimulus. Steel from Australia, natural gas, the kind of resources that China really doesn't have, and all kinds of other goods that they're importing, so that China has a very positive balance of trade with the United States. But with these other countries of Asia, including Japan, it's either even or even a negative balance of trade. So that in many ways, they have been a stimulus to these economies, as well as taking labor away or goods away.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And Bonnie, I know you travel in that area. Is there an acknowledgement then from the other East Asian and Asian economies that China's important because China's in effect pulling them all along?
Well, I think so. China's neighbors very much want to see China succeed. Obviously, they're ambivalent in the sense that they don't want China to emerge too quickly, and they don't want the gap between their own economies and China to be too great. But they do see China as pulling them up, and the Chinese in recent years have become more magnanimous in their approach to dealing with some of their neighbors, particularly economically. They're now talking with members of the Association of East Asian Nations about forging a free trade agreement, for example, that will be very, very beneficial to those countries, perhaps even more beneficial than it will be to China. And yet the Chinese want to send a signal to the people of the region that they are going to be a cooperative power and a responsible power, and that they want to help the region. They want to be part of it, and they don't want to be seen as threatening. And several years ago, there was a lot of discussion about what the Chinese termed the China threat, the fear that China was going to emerge as a very threatening power in the region and in the world. And the Chinese have worked very, very hard over the last 5 years to dispel those fears, and they have done so quite successfully.
All right, let's take a call from Louisville, Kentucky. Kevin's with us on the line now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Dick, I was wondering if your guest would comment, if we assume the economic rise and possible political rise of China to a leadership role, where does that leave us both politically, as it's not like a European fall from power, turn it over to an America that was European descendants. It's very different culturally. And economically, as China is able to fuel its own economy, when we're losing the manufacturing jobs that allows us to make those purchases and fuel our economy, and China can fuel its own, I'm kind of curious as to where we're going to
No, it's a fascinating question, Kevin, because, I mean, Merle, when the Bush administration first came into office, they didn't have a lot of time for China. It was, they were sort of the bad guys over there. Now they have these areas of cooperation, economic war on terror and stuff like that. But Kevin's saying, and what's in the future for Americans? If China continues to grow and boom the way it is, what will the implications be for this country?
It's very true. When the Bush administration came to power, they looked upon China as the major problem, the major contender in the world. But then came September 11th, then came these economic issues, and in some ways China is cooperating with us. So we have a cooperative relationship. Nonetheless, we used to be, or we maybe still are, the dominant power in the Pacific. But now China is becoming that dominant power. And at the same time, Japan, which was a very strong economic power, went through this long recession. They're finally getting out of it. But it's kind of left this vacuum, and China has kind of moved into it. So I think there's no question there's contention there. But at this point in their development, the Chinese want less contention and more cooperation. And if you look at their problems internally, I get back to that all the time, mm-hmm. they have big problems they have to deal with. And in some cases, they don't have a clue as how to deal with them.
And Bonnie, just briefly, because we're a little short on time here, but, you know, if we take the American empire and compare it to what's going on in the European Union, there are historic links and language ties that allow communication there. Is it harder for America and China to figure each other out?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's difficult for the Chinese and the Americans to communicate, not just because of language differences, but because of very deeply rooted cultural systems and different political systems. But I think that both sides are working very, very hard to do that. I would say this is especially true on the Chinese side, because they have now concluded that the United States is likely to remain the sole superpower for at least another 20 to 30 years. And if China is going to emerge as a stronger power, it's going to have to get along with the United States.
Bonnie, I want to thank you for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Bonnie Glaser is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Merle Goldman, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Merle is a scholar at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard. And Kevin, thanks a lot for that question. Smart way to end the program. Earlier in the hour, we were listening to the views of Matthew Forney. He's Time Magazine's Beijing Bureau Chief. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.